morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Liz Oyer for the appellant, Russell Queso. The parties in this case agree that Mr. Queso is actually innocent of the single honest services fraud offense of which he was convicted. The question before the court is whether Mr. Queso must also show that he is actually innocent of the separate and uncharged offense of making a false statement in order to have his habeas petition considered on the merits. In our briefs, we discuss three reasons that Mr. Queso is not required to make such a showing. If this court disagrees with the district court's analysis on any one of these three issues, it should reverse the court's order denying Mr. Queso's petition. If it pleases the court, I will focus my argument time on what I consider the most straightforward of these three issues, which is that a false statement is less serious than honest services fraud, and therefore no showing of actual innocence is required. The dispute on this issue centers on how to measure the relative seriousness of offenses. The government contends that statutory maximum penalties are controlling. We urge the court to look to the U.S. sentencing
guidelines. But the sentencing guidelines take into account many things besides the seriousness of the offense, don't they? I mean, that's not the only thing the sentencing guidelines do.
Well,
that's one factor, but there are all sorts of other factors. So why are the sentencing guidelines a true measure of the seriousness of the offense?
Well, there are a couple of different ways to answer that. One is that the factors apart from the seriousness of the offense that the guidelines takes into account are not really relevant to the relative seriousness of offenses. For example, the guidelines calculate an offense level which reflects the seriousness of the offense, but they also calculate a criminal history category. And the criminal history category, for example, in this case, for Mr. Queso would be the same regardless of the offense of which he is convicted. So his, offense level.
So is the rule you're asking for that we go on a case-by-case basis and see whether the sentencing guidelines for this particular individual would lead to a conclusion that the offense is more serious? That seems quite an inquiry when you can simply look to the U.S. Code and see what Congress thought.
Well, Your Honor, I two points. One is that I would suggest that the relevant portion of the guidelines is the offense level, not the criminal history portion, which may vary from person to person. So I'm suggesting that the court should look at the offense level as determined by the guidelines. But moreover, Congress, in enacting the Sentencing Reform Act in 1984, expressly rejected statutory maximum sentences as an adequate measure of the severity of offenses. Congress said that allowing courts broad discretion to sentence within broad statutory maximums led to unwarranted sentencing disparities and led to too little certainty in sentencing. And it was for precisely this reason that Congress enacted the Sentencing Reform Act and the guidelines structure.
Can I ask whether it really matters from the point of view of what Congress thought was serious? The real question here is, what is the logic or the rationale of the Boozley decision? That is, why does it care about seriousness?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit, and the court did not articulate a rationale in Boozley, which it makes it a little bit problematic, but I would suggest that the purpose of the whole inquiry was essentially to determine whether the prosecutor could have, in all material respects, obtained an identical plea agreement had the prosecutor known that the offense to which the defendant pled guilty was invalid at the time. So I think the best way.
Why does that go to seriousness? I mean, you could also have gotten a lesser offense. So that doesn't really fit, right? I mean, if the prosecutor could have gotten a higher offense, it's more likely he could have gotten a lower offense than could have gotten a more serious offense. Isn't the real issue here having something either to do with bargaining, that is, what would the defendant have given up, or what would the prosecutor have given up, or with fairness, namely, would you have gotten the same sentence? And if those were the cases, if either one of those are the rationales, then you're right, that the only thing that really matters here is sentencing guidelines. No real lawyer who does plea bargaining looks at the maximum sentence. They look at least for now at the sentencing guidelines, even post-Booker, because that is a much better judge of what either the person they're prosecuting or the person they're defending will get. So isn't that that seems like a better reason for why we should look at sentencing guidelines.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I think that that is borne out here. In this case, had the parties understood that the honest services fraud offense to which Mr. Queso pled guilty was invalid, the prosecutor would have had to accept a plea to a false statement offense in the alternative. That was the only other offense on the table. And that's an offense that carries a significantly lower offense level under the guidelines. There's no dispute about that.
And if that had happened, the sentence might have been lower, that's your argument here, than it is, and that would be unfair to hold somebody to a higher sentence.
Exactly.
For a crime that is now void.
Exactly, Your Honor. Under the guidelines, a false statement would have had an offense level of 6, whereas Mr. Queso's honest services fraud offense carried an offense level of 18. So the offense level is substantially lower. In addition, with an offense level of 6, the recommended sentence would be a term of probation without a period of home confinement, without a period of imprisonment. It would have been a purely probationary sentence, and that's what Mr. Queso would have faced had he had the opportunity to plead guilty only to a false statement. But moreover, we don't know that if Mr. Queso had been charged only with a false statement, that he even would have elected to plead guilty at all. Knowing that his guideline sentencing range was probation without even a reduction for acceptance of responsibility, Mr. Queso may well have decided to litigate the case, to file a suppression motion, to defend the case on either the facts or the law, perhaps to assert a legal defense such as materiality, because, you know, facing only a probationary sentence, even if convicted, he really didn't have much to lose by going to trial and trying to avoid having a felony conviction on his record and all of the collateral consequences.
Of course, you could make a sort of the inverse argument with respect to a more serious offense. If he thought that a more serious offense was out there, and he knew that the lesser offense was void, he might have decided to go to trial rather than accept the higher sentence. So it sort of explodes the whole theory behind Boozley. It makes it difficult to believe that that's actually the theory about Boozley, which is what the defendant might bargain for.
Well, I think the question is whether the outcome would have been the same in terms of the amount of punishment that the defendant received had the parties known at the time that the one charge was invalid. And I think here the answer is no, either because there would have been a guilty plea that resulted in less punishment, or there would have been no guilty plea, and even if convicted at trial, Mr. Queso would have faced less punishment. That's the rationale that the Seventh Circuit in the Lewis case imputed to Boozley, a concern that a defendant might receive a windfall by getting off scot-free in a case where he would have faced equal punishment had the government simply substituted in a different charge for the charge of conviction. But here, there is no equally serious charge that the government could have substituted in. So the possibility that existed in Lewis is not present here, that the prosecutor could have simply used a different charge and the outcome for all practical purposes would have been the same.
Well, is it significant that in these other cases, Boozley and the two circuit cases that everyone's talking about, there was an indictment with a dismissed charge? So the record evidence as to what was going on was clear on the face, and everything you've been talking about what a defendant might have done, I mean, that's all speculative here. And it's also speculative of what the government might have done. And so I'm just interested in the notion that in those cases, you know, the charge was clear, or the charges were clear.
Well, Your Honor, we take the position in our briefs that the best rule for the court to adopt is not to require a showing of actual innocence of any offense that's not actually charged in an indictment or information.
Well, what I'm getting at is that those cases were in the context of there was an indictment. And much of this discussion about what do you look to the statutory maximum or the guideline for seriousness, goes to the fact that this was a pre-indictment plea. So it's just a different circumstance. And in trying to understand Boozley in that context, it seems to me, I'm just curious as to whether your argument about we must look only at the charge document.
Well, Your Honor, there are no cases that I'm aware of, the government hasn't cited one, in which a court has required a showing of actual innocence of a charge that was allegedly foregone prior to a charging decision being made. So there are no cases in which a court actually applies this Boosley requirement to a pre-indictment, to a pre-indictment case. And I think the reason for that is that it is so difficult to go back and reconstruct history in order to determine what charge may or may not have been foregone when the
charge... Well, this didn't seem to be particularly difficult. They submitted an affidavit from the prosecutor.
Well, that's true that an affidavit was submitted here. I don't know that all cases would be, the information would be preserved in all cases. Habeas petition...
Well, if it's not preserved, then... It's not preserved. They don't get the benefit of it. But where it is preserved, where they
I think it would be a better rule. It would be simpler for purposes of administrability and predictability for the court to look only to the charging document in all cases and to adopt a rule that was easily administrable across all cases.
Boosley refers to records or to admissibility of evidence outside the record. Why shouldn't that be the standard for us? And that's not so limited to the charging document, is it?
Boosley's reference to evidence outside the record being admissible is in the context of the central dispute, the dispute on the merits of whether the petitioner is actually innocent of the charged offense.
But its reference to record evidence is really exactly on the point we're talking about. The court says... In this case, the government maintains that the petitioner must demonstrate he is actually innocent of both using and carrying, but petitioner's indictment charged him only with using indictment, and there is no record evidence that the government elected not to charge petitioner with carrying. So at least in Boosley, the court looked, and there wasn't any record evidence, but the court didn't adopt the rule that you're talking about.
No, and again, this is dictum upon dictum in Boosley because...
What I'm trying to understand is it found there was no record evidence, and is the record evidence that the court had in mind something, as you suggest, was contemporaneous evidence, not something that's created now? I mean, Boosley's been on the books for a number of years. The government's had plenty of opportunity to craft these plea agreements and statement of offenses in a manner to address this issue.
Yes, I think that the court, if the court is inclined to look beyond the charging document, it should look only to the existing record as it existed at the time of plea negotiations. I think that's what the court was contemplating in Boosley, and that record would consist of the plea agreement and the plea colloquy on the record.
And that's because we don't trust the district court to evaluate the government's newly proffered evidence?
It's principally because it opens the gates to an evidentiary hearing on a wholly collateral issue. This is sort of a threshold question of what charges were foregone, yet...
There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, it just seems that it would be unduly burdensome and time-consuming to have a separate evidentiary hearing on this collateral question. And
okay, but let's assume you're right on that. That doesn't get to the heart of the question. Why wouldn't we have confidence in the district court to evaluate any later proffered evidence by the government?
Well, I think that certainly... courts are able to evaluate that type of evidence, but a habeas petitioner may not have the opportunity to meaningfully refute the government's evidence.
Well, what I had in mind was here the prosecutor's affidavit says he told defense counsel about this other charge, and presumably if there was, you know, defense counsel kept notes, then he could say, well, you know, my notes don't show any such, you know, discussion or offer was made, etc. I mean, I just need to understand why you think it's other than burdensome to the district court, improper to allow that type of evidence in a pre-indictment case.
Well, I think there will likely be cases in which the habeas petitioner's counsel is no longer accessible to the petitioner, and the petitioner, therefore, may not have a meaningful opportunity to refute the government's presentation of evidence. But this isn't
an issue. Can't the court handle that in those cases, but where you have a case where you do have evidence of it, like this case, why shouldn't the district court be looking at that?
My suggestion is that the court should adopt a rule that would apply easily across all cases. But in this case, the court doesn't need to adopt any rule on this point because the easier basis to determine that Mr. Queso's petition should be heard on the merits is that a false statement is plainly a less serious offense by any measure than the offense of honest services fraud. And I've spoken about the guidelines. I have a few more points on the guidelines.
That's a question before you get to the guidelines. Your client waived the statute of limitations, correct?
There's a provision in the plea agreement that relates to the statute of limitations.
Called waiver.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you win, don't you just go to trial?
On a false statement charge?
Yes, your client said at the sentencing hearing, question from the court, you knew you were lying, defendant, yes, sir. Seems like a lay-down case for the government. What's the advantage here of disputing this?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the question is so simple. I think it's a question that if the court were to reverse, the district court would have to be resolved another day.
Issue would have to be resolved another day?
Whether the government's prosecution for a false statement would be time-barred.
Well, can you tell me why it would be? I mean, maybe it would be. The waiver says anything that's not time-barred as of the date of the waiver is not time-barred, and that's less than a year, I think, after the offense. So,
well, I think there are two issues that would need to be considered. One is that the plea agreement also contains a provision stating that Mr. Queso would not be further prosecuted for conduct known to the government at the date of the plea agreement. I think there would be an argument that those two provisions are in conflict and perhaps the agreement should be construed in favor of the defendant.
I have to say, if you come back here, that sounds like a complete loser. The waiver of statute of limitations says it is further agreed that should the conviction following your client's plea of guilty pursuant to this agreement be vacated for any reason, then any prosecution that is not time-barred by the applicable statute of limitations on the date of the signing may be commenced.
Well, I think the other possibility is that invalidating this conviction would invalidate the plea agreement in its entirety, and it's not an issue that I have researched thoroughly, but I think that it's an issue that we would have to litigate a different day.
Justice Stevens' point in Boosley. Do you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes. May I make just one additional point in response to Judge Garland's last question? I do think also that Mr. Queso could assert legal defenses in the context of a false statement prosecution that he hasn't asserted, for example, a materiality defense, or, for example, a defense related to the speech and debate clause since he was a public official. So I don't know that the prosecution...
You think that the speech or debate clause protects against prosecutions for false filing of disclosure statements?
I think that
issue has been resolved already. There have been dozens of people prosecuted for that.
Your Honor, I think that would arise more in the context of a suppression motion, potentially. I didn't represent Mr. Queso at trial, and I don't know all the facts and circumstances by which the evidence that the government has was obtained, but I think certainly that Mr. Queso...
You have his admissions, though now, regardless of how it was obtained. He has admissions before a court. He wouldn't be able to defend himself.
This isn't in this case, is it?
Well, the reason I ask this question is it affects this case in the sense that the government is concerned that unless we have the rule that it wants, it can't protect itself. And I'm going to ask the government, isn't one way of protecting itself to have these statute of limitations waivers in here? Now, if there's a reason why statute of limitations waivers don't work, then maybe the government is right that it can't protect itself.
Why don't we hear from the government?
Okay. Thank you.
Please report. Lauren Bates on behalf of Appellee of the United States. And I will pick up with the question that Judge Garland indicated that he would have for the government, which is how would the government protect itself here? And I think there are two concerns. First is the government's concern.
What about the statute of limitations? Why isn't that a protection?
It is a level of protection, but it doesn't take into account that there would be other hurdles that the government could face, reinstating a prosecution some years after a plea was entered, such as the availability of witnesses or other evidence, in order to pursue and see through that prosecution. But also there's a concern separate from just the government protecting itself here, and that's the concern, given that this case is in the posture where appellant has procedurally defaulted his claim, and it's one of finality.
Well, let's go back to the government protecting itself. Boothley's been on the books for a number of years. Why can't the government protect itself through the plea agreement itself? Judge Garland has mentioned one provision where it's a pre-indictment plea. Why couldn't the government just state on the record at that time, yeah, we could have charged you with X, but we've agreed to allow you to plead to Y? Isn't that a perfect way for the government to protect itself? What's wrong with it? Let me put that.
I don't think that there's anything wrong with the government doing that. And here what the government did was put on the record in terms of the plea agreement that as part of the plea agreement, the government would forego its opportunity or ability to prosecute any other offenses arising out of the conduct set forth in the statement of facts. The government did not, in this case, have an explicit list where it enumerated what those specific offenses are. But I think that this court can look to the statement of facts, the conduct there, the information that was filed, and
what I'm getting at is, in this case, as I read the record, what the government really wanted was to get this guy, this defendant, to give them information about his boss, so they could go after his boss, so the government could go after his boss. And yet, because there was this failure to disclose, it wasn't going to let this defendant off scot-free either. So I'm just concerned about the ramifications of how far this case goes.
And
this is this pre-indictment situation.
That is correct. And so I think this goes most directly perhaps to the question of what must the government show to show what charges were foregone as part of a plea agreement. And here, I think the fact that this is pre-indictment is a very important factor for this court to consider, because
if you didn't have the statement of offense here, if it was significantly different, and all you had was the affidavit of the prosecutor, is that sufficient?
I think it would be a much more difficult case for the government. The affidavit is evidence and is now record evidence that the government consciously, at the time of this plea, forewent charging false statement and, in fact, discussed that.
You could always have that kind of statement, it seems to me. That's what I'm getting at. As to, in Boothley and in the Seventh and Third Circuit cases, you had an indictment. So it was clear on the record as far as, and the court didn't talk about, charges that the government might have brought where an indictment, was not filed, but the government might have been able to have gotten an indictment on additional charges. So there was a confined universe, and I'm trying to understand the nature of the confined universe in the pre-indictment situation.
Boothley did not limit the inquiry to charges that the government had already brought. And I think that it's clear from Boothley's reference to looking first at the indictment and then looking also to whether there is other record evidence. Here, the government is not arguing that the rule should be that the government can show that it might have charged any other conceivable crime. I think the government agrees that that would be too broad of a rule. But here, where there's evidence that the government consciously forewent a charge at the time of the plea agreement.
So, ignore the affidavit for a moment. Is it the government's position that were it not able to get an affidavit, then the statement of offense is to be reviewed for what charge might have been possible based on the facts stated there?
I think that the court should look to where a plea agreement specifically states that the charges that the government is agreeing not to prosecute in exchange or as part of the plea agreement are the charges that would arise from that statement of offense, that the court could look to that. I think that is a more difficult case because there would not be the clear record evidence that we have here of the prosecutor indicating that that was a conscious decision to forego a specific charge. But I don't know that the government would necessarily lose in a case where all that there was a statement in a plea agreement that the government agreed to forego charges arising out of a certain universe and a limited universe of conduct.
One of the issues that the appellant raises in terms of the consideration of fairness is how could you ever rebut, you know, a statement by a prosecutor that, well, what I had in mind was, you know, offense A, but I agreed to offense B. You can't read a prosecutor's mind. You probably can't get a hold of his notes, if there are any. And maybe the defense attorney has his records, but he may have a record destruction policy, too, such that he doesn't hang on to these old records after a certain period of time. So years later, the defendant is in this odd position of, you know, the prosecutor says, well, he had in mind some other offense.
I think that is where the district court's role as a fact finder in determining whether the prosecutor's statement is one that is credible would come into play. The defendants.
How could the court make that judgment in my hypothetical situation? No defense attorney notes. It's just the prosecutor's word. As an officer of the court, he must be believed.
No, I don't think that. I think as an officer of the court, you would hope that a prosecutor would not put forth an affidavit that was not true, but the district court would still be left on its own to make its determination as to whether
based
to credit
what?
That.
No.
Hypothetically, the district court could look to the conduct that was set forth in the statement of facts question the prosecutor. If you thought that you had a basis to bring this other charge, why is there no suggestion in what was discussed and set forth in this statement of facts of any evidence that would support that charge?
I mean, suppose the statement of offense talks about, you know, matters A, B, C, and D that might have been charged, but the government knew jolly well it didn't have the evidence for some of those other charges. Yet now, later, the defendant has to prove his innocence to A, B, C, and D, even though they were never charged?
I think the evidence in the statement of offense is what is agreed that the government would be able to prove, and the defendant, as part of the plea agreement, signs and adopts that the facts set forth in the statement of offense are the facts to which the defendant is admitting as part of the plea agreement. And so I'm not sure that where
these statements of offenses go beyond just that. This is what the government would offer to prove. And in the course of saying that, it's focusing on what's at issue, not whether or not some other, what I'll call collateral facts that are in the statement of offense could also be proved. Yet if we take your scenario, the defendant would be responsible for proving his innocence as to even those offenses. That's what I'm trying to understand, how this works.
The scenario it does, and I think the court's concern here appears to be one of what would the limiting principle be. And the government is not asking that the rule or asking this court to interpret Boosley to allow the government to make a showing that it could have brought or conceivably could have brought any charge, but to limit that showing to what the government consciously forewent at the time of the plea, and that that would serve as the limiting principle, and that a defendant in that situation could come back. It is not inconceivable, especially in a case such as this, where the affidavit from the prosecutor clearly states that the prosecutor not only thought about that charge and himself consciously forewent it, but in fact discussed that charge as a charge that was being foregone as part of the plea.
But since we agree that it has to have been a charge that was contemplated at the time, what is wrong with the suggestion of Judge Rogers that the plea agreement simply lists the charges that were foregone. Why doesn't that absolutely protect the government in future cases?
I think that it could be other evidence in future cases. Here, what the plea agreement did was indicate that the charges
you,
that
were you have no problem with respect to future cases doing it that way, then. You can't say, well, we couldn't think of all the future charges because, of course, it has to be the ones you did think of. So there really isn't any problem with listing them in the plea agreement, is there?
No, but there's. I don't think there's a problem with that, but I don't believe that Boozley, or as the law stands now, requires that, given that Boozley refers to looking to record evidence, does not limit that referral to contemporaneous or use some limiting principle.
Well, it doesn't tell us at all what it means by record. That's left for the courts of appeals and the district courts to decide.
That is, and this court could look to the fact that Boozley was not limiting the inquiry, at least with respect to other aspects of the actual innocence exception, to contemporaneous record evidence, but was aware that in these situations where you have a claim that has been procedurally defaulted some years later, that it was would be necessary to have new evidence to answer some of these questions.
Right, so we're just trying to understand the limits, all right? Boozley wasn't a treatise on the whole area. It's just dealing with the case before it. And what limits are reasonably placed or none?
I think the government's position is that the reasonable limit here is to allow, especially in the context of a pre-indictment plea, where none of the parties were contemplating at the time that we would be here today, you know, with this charge having been one that can no longer stand as a charge of conviction based on the facts of plea questioning what the government was foregone. The plea agreement did not account for that possibility, but it's clear that there's evidence here to show that the government did consciously forego another charge, and that charge is one that appellant must show that he is also actually innocent of to overcome the procedural default. Were there not, or could, if the government could not make such a evidentiary showing, we would be in a very different position, one where I think the court would be rightfully concerned that to say any conceivable charge would be a very broad rule, and one that was probably too broad.
And I switch. We have three. Yes. You have a number of other issues before you. So let me ask you, why is it that the government thinks it has to be a more serious charge rather than just an equal charge?
I think first, Boozley itself, appellant asked this court to read it as limited to more serious, and in essence, that single sentence in Boozley, reading the word only, more serious charges there. Boozley itself looked to in the next paragraph and contemplated that if the government had foregone, if there was record evidence that the government had foregone what is an equally serious charge, that the showing of actual innocence would also extend to that. And that.
What's a theory? What's a theory about why? Your theory is equal or more serious.
Right? Yes.
You're clear that a lesser is not good enough, right?
Yes, because I think
And what's the theory?
The concern here is someone is leaving someone standing with a conviction where they are not or could show that they are innocent of any other conviction at the same level, that if someone is convicted of and sentenced to a crime but is actually innocent of all conduct except for something lesser, that they would be in a situation. It would be a situation, as Lewis points out, where it is more likely than not that they received a sentence or a level of punishment, were exposed to a criminal charge that they would not have otherwise faced. And so here.
Why is that? I'm not sure I understand the logic of that. Judge Posner says that if the parties knew the lower charge was void, the defendant, who we know wanted to plead guilty, would probably have pled guilty to the more serious charge. That strikes me as completely wrong, at least in most cases. That is, many defendants decide to go to trial on more serious charges because the risk of jail is considerably higher. I mean, you might well decide to plead to something that's just going to get you probation, but you're not going to plead to something that gets you 10 years. Some people have the opposite view. Some people have a different set of risk averseness. But I don't think there's any particular rule one way or the other about how people bargain on this.
No, and I think Lewis recognizes that it is not an absolute, that you cannot apply that rule to every situation.
Or to every defendant or to every prosecutor.
To every defendant or every prosecutor. But that it is, I think in Lewis's world, whereas that there's no reason to believe that a defendant who pled guilty to one charge, but it faced with an equally serious charge, had that been substituted, would not have pled guilty. And again, the concern here is...
Well, I'm wondering why whether that is really the concern. There's a separate part of Lewis toward the end where it seems to be mixing in a different concern, what he describes as windfall, but might more appropriately be described as fairness. That is, a defendant shouldn't get stuck with a longer sentence than the one that the defendant thought he was bargaining within the possible range of.
And I think that Lewis's concern there, stepping back, is tied to the concept of where there's a procedural default. The concerns are finality on one hand versus a manifest injustice on the other, or a fairness concern on the other. And that the fairness concern is present where someone has been convicted of a more serious crime than they otherwise would be exposed to now.
So if that's the rule, so if that's the underlying rationale, why aren't the sentencing guidelines the appropriate way to go rather than maximum exposure? When you do a plea bargain, do you really look at the maximum exposure? You don't think the judge is going to give the maximum exposure. You think the judge is going to be guided by the sentencing guidelines, even though they're advisory. In Gall, the court said, we look at the sentencing guidelines first.
I think when pleas occur and when a plea colloquy occurs, it is required that the parties be aware of and that the defendant, in fact, be informed of the statutory maximum.
Why then isn't this not either an equal or more serious charge but a lower charge? Because sentencing guidelines seems to be undisputed. At least the offense guidelines, since criminal history was the same, the offense guideline in this case was at the most, I guess, was 18. And then minus 3, and under the false statement charge, it would have been 6, and maybe 2 for abuse of trust, 8. So this is, under that scenario, any defendant thinking about what their sentence might be would see a sentencing guidelines considerably higher than for the false state for the honest services fraud than for the false statement.
Appellant suggests that the guidelines here are different and that the false or honest services fraud charge would have much more exposure under the guidelines. But appellant's asking this court to look at the guidelines to only a certain degree.
Which degree?
But to ignore.
Which degree? We know from the pre-sentence report exactly what the guideline prediction was, right? The pre-sentence report in this very case said 18 minus 3, right?
We also know that appellant disagreed that that was the appropriate calculation of
whatever,
the guidelines.
That was the one that was the, and in what way was it, maybe, but it's the one adopted by the pre-sentence in the pre-sentence report.
It is the guideline range set forth in the pre-sentence report, but in this case, as all the parties agreed at the sentencing hearing, it didn't matter whether
never matters. Never matters anymore, and if you think of it that way. But I'd be surprised if your office doesn't go into bargaining thinking about the guidelines, even though they're only advisory.
And there may be a number of factors that the parties go into plea bargaining thinking about. And that the question is, are those factors, the guidelines alone, the best measurement of what the
You don't really think that the statutory maximum is the factor that a real prosecutor thinks about in a case like this?
I think this
nobody thinks they were going to get the statutory maximum.
The statutory maximum is the factor that Congress set.
But that's not what you said. You told me that what we're really looking at here is manifest injustice, unfairness, what a defendant might get if they pled to one thing versus another. And that's not really related to what Congress regarded as serious, is it?
I think it is related to the exposure under the statutory maximums. The statutory maximums are the ultimate outer limits of what the possible exposure is. The way in which Congress has ranked all of the various criminal offenses, and there's if the inquiry, if we take it all the way down that road to what would this defendant actually get, we go beyond the statutory guidelines. The guidelines won't answer that question.
I'm asking you, when you actually do a plea bargain, do you look at the question of statutory maximum, or is a real question, what do the advisory guidelines suggest?
I would think that most prosecutors would look at both of those factors and a number of other factors. It's clear that the parties would look to the guidelines. That's one of the elements discussed in the plea agreement. It's also the statutory maximums are set forth as one of the topics that was part of the discussion and is part of any plea agreement. The prosecutor may also look to a number of other factors.
That is not based on your actual experience with plea agreements, is it? What you're saying now? That they look at at the maximum exposure in deciding to make the plea?
Well, I think prosecutors look at a number of other factors that I'm not sure go to the question here of seriousness of an offense. The prosecutor may look to the strength of its evidence on certain charges, the difficulty in terms of the cost of proving certain charges and what evidence is available, potential defenses. There may be
a
bargaining
But the Supreme Court told us to look at seriousness. They didn't tell us to look at the other things.
Correct. And the government's position is that the appropriate measure of seriousness, setting aside these other considerations, is the statutory maximums, which are the only limit on the sentence that can be imposed by the judge.
Do you agree if we looked at offense level as set forth in the guidelines that your opponent's right? Right, the offense level here for false statement is less than the offense level for honest services fraud. Is that right?
That appears to be the position appellant is taking now, although it
is that right?
Different position than what appellant took in the lower court.
Is that right, though? Is she right that the offense level for false statement is less than the offense level for honest services fraud?
If you applied Section 2C1.1 to honest services fraud, that does yield a higher offense level, base offense level, than applying Section 2B1.1 to false statement. But I think that leaves open the question, which is one of the difficulties in looking to the guidelines on this point, which is that there's a large degree of uncertainty, evidenced by the fact in this case that there was a dispute over what guideline sections would apply to the honest services charge. Appellant arguing that Section 2B1.1 applied because this was, in all essence, as appellant said, the conduct here was a false statement.
But I suppose the point is that in plea bargaining, you are interested in what the prosecutor thinks applies. And he's going to argue, or she's going to argue to the district court, that 2C applies, not 2B. Let me just ask you, the appellant cites the U.S. Attorney's Manual advising prosecutors to look to the sentencing guidelines in plea negotiations. Is that correct? It's in her brief.
There is a section in the U.S. Attorney's Manual that does indicate that it's part of pleas, prosecutors look at the sentencing guidelines and that may generally reflect information regarding the seriousness of the offense.
Doesn't it say you're supposed to bargain for the most serious charge as defined by the guidelines?
Yes, with caveats regarding the most serious charge that the prosecutor believes could be proven.
Yes, of course. The most serious charge that can be proven.
And that is guidance. That is, I don't think, controls. It also doesn't answer what the most serious charge for purposes of plea bargaining is versus what most serious means for purposes of the Boosley analysis and actual innocence showing. And I will also say, I mean, it is clear that the U.S. Attorney's Manual is not legally binding, does not provide any rights. It does not set forth.
Just trying to figure out the prosecutor's mindset in plea bargaining, that's all. Anything further?
No, just briefly, I think if the court would indulge me, that I would just point out with respect to the guidelines versus statutory maximums, I think there is another difficulty here, which is evidenced by the fact that there are many situations where it is clear that the statutory maximums, when in conflict with the guidelines, prevail. That would be where they lead to different results. It is the statutory maximums that are the ultimate decision maker. where the guidelines lead to a range that is higher than a statutory maximum. It is the statutory maximum that governs. Where there's a mandatory minimum, it's the statutory maximum that governs.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant. Give you a minute or two.
Your Honors, picking up on the subject of the U.S. Attorney's Manual, there is another relevant section in addition to the one cited in our brief, the section that follows 927-400, that expressly discusses plea bargaining, and it references the guidelines throughout. There are three particularly relevant provisions. One is the provision that expressly directs prosecutors to seek pleas to the most serious provable offense as determined by the guidelines. Two, there is a provision that directs prosecutors not to bargain away readily provable charges unless they would have no effect on the guidelines calculation in the case. And three, there is a provision that states plea bargaining, both charge bargaining and sentence bargaining, I'm skipping a little, must be accomplished through appropriate guideline provisions. So clearly, the U.S. Attorney's Office, like defense counsel, conducts plea negotiations under the auspices of the guidelines. That was also the case here, in which the plea agreement expressly stated that the government would agree not to oppose a sentence at the low end of the sentencing guidelines range determined by the court.
Can you explain why an equal charge wouldn't be enough, why it has to be a greater charge?
Well, I think that the...
A more serious charge.
Right. Maybe the terminology is that's being used right now isn't the best, but I think the issue is whether the defendant would end up punished more severely than he would have been had the other charge.
You do argue in your brief that it has to be more serious, that the equivalent would not be sufficient, right?
I think that because...
And that doesn't fit with what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the simplest rule would be to follow Boozley by its strict terms and apply the term more serious literally. But even looking to the rationale that courts have looked to, such as the Seventh Circuit, for saying that equally serious is enough, still that wouldn't encompass this case here.
I understand. You win even without it if we were to use sentencing guidelines rather than statutory maximums. But just for fun, assume that we're going to go the other way on that. But you do make an argument that it has to be more serious rather than equal. And given that Boozley did consider the question of whether there was using or carrying, and those were both, under any theory, equally serious, why should we look only at the more serious charge?
Well, the court didn't render a holding in Boozley on whether the charges at issue were more or equally serious, and I think the simplest and most straightforward way to apply Boozley's dictum is simply to hold that the Supreme Court said more serious, and therefore the inquiry should be limited to more serious charges, which is what at least one other circuit has concluded.
Why is this even dictum? Why do you say it's dictum? The court says, the court makes a decision in response to the government's argument. The government argued that he's actually he had to show both using and carrying. The court says, well, there's no evidence that they ever considered carrying.
Well, I would say it's dictum.
That doesn't sound like dictum. That sounds like a decision.
It's dictum in the sense that the court did not render a holding on whether the two charges were equally or more serious.
What would be the theory about if they were equally, why that wouldn't be good enough? What's the rationale for thinking that that wouldn't be good enough if they were equal? Say the sentencing guidelines were identical.
Your Honor, I think there is some logic to the rationale of the Seventh Circuit, which is that what the court should really be looking to is the actual punishment that the defendant should face, would face under the two different.
And if they were equal, that would be okay then?
It might be. But I want to point out that even applying statutory maximum sentences, which is what the government is advocating for here, a false statement charge is still less serious than an offense of honest services fraud. The maximum penalty for the substantive offense of honest services fraud is 20 years. The maximum penalty for conspiracy to commit honest services wire fraud is 20 years. The fact that this conspiracy was charged in this case under Section 371, which has a five-year statutory maximum, should not be controlling. The government's argument is that statutory maximums somehow reflect Congress's view of the severity of offenses. Clearly, Congress views honest services fraud as a more serious offense than making a false statement because it has legislated a 20-year statutory maximum for that offense. I want to point out also that the guidelines, more so than statutory maximums, actually reflect Congress's view of the relative severity of offenses. This is what the Supreme Court recognized in Mistretta when it upheld the guidelines against a non-delegation challenge. The court determined that the guidelines were enacted pursuant to specific and detailed guidance from Congress that was legislated in 28 U.S.C. Section 994, and the court determined that the guidance was so detailed that, in fact, Congress had legislated a full hierarchy of punishment. In addition, the Supreme Court in Booker bent over backwards to preserve the guidelines because the court recognized that the guidelines were Congress's view of how punishment should be conducted. It's for this reason that the court determined that the provision making the guidelines mandatory could be severed, and therefore the guidelines in all other respects would be
preserved. I don't think the court would have described itself as bending over backwards. That may be what commentators think, but that's not the court.
Okay, perhaps I'm not characterizing it in a way that the court would agree with, but what happened there is the court severed a single provision of the Sentencing Reform Act in order to allow the guidelines to continue to be used as the central focus of sentencing.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.